This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Electronics and computers have already changed how we deal with money through ATM machines and credit cards. The next advance might get rid of cash altogether. Electronic money, or e-money, is on the way. My guest Stephen Levy looks ahead at e-money in the December issue of Wired, the cyberculture magazine. Levy has been writing about computer culture for years. He's the author of the book Hackers and Artificial Life about artificial intelligence. His book Insanely Great on the history of the Macintosh has just come out in paperback. He's now working on a book about digital cryptography. E-money would make it possible for you to carry one plastic card instead of money. I asked Stephen Levy how that would be different from an ATM card.
Well, ATM machines are, in essence, a withdrawal from the bank that's just done by a machine as opposed to a teller. Electronic money is going to be the replacement of the cash in your pocket with some sort of digital equivalent, and that makes a lot of difference.
So give me an example of what it might be like to shop if I had e-money.
Well, since you use credit cards, you probably use credit cards, you're familiar with using plastic to buy things. The difference would be that the things that you normally pay for with cash would also be paid with probably something called the smart card, which looks like a credit card but actually has a computer chip on it. And you would buy not only purchases from clothing at the Gap or whatever, but you'd go to McDonald's and use a smart card there. You might even give it to your news vendor at the corner. You'd use it for phones. And you might even give it to the mendicant down the street who asks you for some money. He or she will have a smart card reader, and you could just flick it in and, you know, say how much money you want to give to the person asking for some help.
What are some of the problems or deficiencies with actual money that electronic money would address?
Actually, money is pretty messy. It costs, it's billions of dollars of people to process it. And one of the things I got into when I was doing the e-money story for Wired was I really learned from people who handle money how expensive and unpleasant it is to use it. There's a whole infrastructure of protecting this money, because once you lose it, unless you have the serial numbers marked down, you really can't trace it. Even if you have the serial numbers marked down, people don't check it as they take it. So there's a whole infrastructure of Brinks cards and accounting that goes into it that we wind up paying on with all our purchases. So if we got rid of those costs, presumably electronic money could be cheaper than real money.
But isn't there like a huge bureaucracy that would be in place if we were using completely computerized money?
It's kind of interesting. The way it's shaping up, and this in a sense is a little alarming, is that it's going totally of its own volition. There's no regulatory commission looking at it. The government really doesn't seem to have much interest in printing, so to speak, electronic money the way they print physical money. So we're going to have, unless something moves in to stop it, a whole series of dozens, maybe even hundreds of private currencies that are going to circulate both in these smart cards and, probably even more so on computer networks.
Now, I know when I use my credit card, when my bill comes due, then I first have to go to the bank, get out the money, get a check, mail it to the credit card company. I wouldn't have to do that with e-money. It's just one step. It gets deducted from your account through your card, and that's it. There's no follow-up.
Exactly. At a much earlier point, the bank might get involved, or you might have your payroll go directly to some sort of digital wallet you have, and you'll pay out from there. So the bank might never get involved in this. You might have certified, digital cash paid to you as part of your job, and then you would pay it out to for your mortgage or your car or whatever bills you have. Now the key is, and as I explain this, maybe you're thinking, gee, where does this get traced? That you could make this electronic money either anonymous or traceable. And if it's anonymous, the government has quite a problem tracking where this money goes, how much you get. And, some people, particularly, I guess, those in the IRS, are aghast at the thought of anonymous electronic money coming into being.
Why is the IRS so upset about it?
Well, the way they keep an eye on us, so to speak, isn't so much, what we report. To in certain extent, what we report to the IRS is voluntary, but the way they check things off is our employers give us money, and then they report how much money they pay to us. And the banks keep records on, where we store our money and, what goes in and what goes out. So all this is a check against the essentially voluntary nature of the way we report things to the IRS. Now, if there were no accounting mechanisms to keep track of this, we would be on a total honor system of what we report to the IRS. And, once people perceive that there's no penalty, there's no way they can catch you, the suspicion is that people might not be as honest as they are now.
Traceability is one of the really big controversies now in these early stages of electronic money. Would you describe what traceability is?
Sure. When you have a credit card, particularly some of the gold versions of credit cards, at the end of the year, you get a report which says everything you've spent on this credit card, and they break it down by category. And if you use that one credit card a lot, as it turns out, it's almost a diary of where you've been, where you've spent money. And, in theory, I guess you could even go back to the stores and check their accounts, and you could see what you've read and if they keep track of the books in the books you buy books, the bookstore you buy books at, and et cetera. Now, that's only for that credit card, and you could avoid being traced on that if you want to buy something that you don't want a record of at, say, an adult bookstore, by paying cash. Now, if we're using digital cash and it's traceable, virtually everything you buy can be traced. That end-of-the-year accounting can go back in the detail of saying, on this morning, so-and-so bought a New York Times and then went into an adult bookstore and bought these publications. So having total traceability can be dangerous in a lot of ways. And a lot of people are very uncomfortable with having the same degree of traceability with cash that we have with credit cards.
So who's for traceability? Who's against it?
Well, as you might suspect, the IRS kind of likes traceability. And law enforcement is, again, as you might suspect, is, very eager not to see electronic cash come in an untraceable way. Really, this could be a paradise for money launderers. The whole infrastructure of sending money overseas and laundering it through so-called legitimate publications that underground organizations, the mafia, might use could, be totally eliminated. They could do this without any problem at all. And this makes law enforcement very nervous. They have a nightmare of seeing the whole drug economy, freed of some of its most onerous burdens. On the other hand, they see a great opportunity for traceable cash, and in that it can almost eliminate the black market, the underground economy, by keeping track of everything.
And people who are opposed to traceability who are afraid that it will violate their privacy.
Absolutely. Privacy groups are very concerned about this. Since we don't have electronic money right now, it's sort of an abstraction to a lot of citizens. But as I talked to one person working for DigiCash, which is a company that wants anonymous money to come into play, he says, when you start to tell people that every penny you spent will be traced, people become a little uncomfortable.
My guest is computer columnist Stephen Levy, and he has a new article in the latest edition of Wired magazine about electronic money. Stephen, do you think electronic money is definitely the wave of the future?
I don't see how it could be stopped. As you said in the top of the show, we do have a lot of forms of electronic money, whether it's using ATM machines, changing that electronic money from the bank to cash, or credit cards. And certainly, the banks are very familiar with the concept of electronic money. All the big money, really, is electronically held.
Already?
Yeah.
Now, what about my security? Say we have an electronic money system and all my money is represented on a card. What if I lose it?
Depending on the system. That's one drawback of anonymous cash. In a lot of the schemes where the money would be anonymous and untraceable, if you lost the card, you'd lose the money. So what you would do to prevent that is not download big sums into the card. You wouldn't carry around a card with, $3,000, say, worth of electronic money, no more than you would carry around $3,000 in your wallet.
Do the people who are working on electronic money systems believe that electronic money will totally replace real money? Will there be a day when there are no pennies and dollar bills anymore?
I find that hard to believe personally. Take a look at how people hold on to their pennies. I think there's been a lot of attempts to, you know, get rid of pennies, which basically just gather around until people have them in jars so big that the banks won't even take them and cash them in. Yet people are attached to them. I think the same thing's going to happen to physical money, that it's going to be politically very difficult to get rid of it. But we're just going to see more and more places that eventually decide not to take physical money.
Do you think that money is going to have an existential crisis?
I think so. You know, and we haven't talked a bit about money on the network, and I think that's really a very big area that's going to make a big difference. But when things become totally electronic, money becomes very much different. It's less of something you pull out of your pocket and spend, as more as one of your features, like who you are. You know, I play sometimes these, you know, kind of Dragons and Dungeons adventure games, and these characters all have certain attributes of power and strength, and money is one of them. And I think we're going to walk around like that with one of our attributes is just, you know, a cash flow. And you won't think of, you know, buying something as spending money, but more like releasing some of your energy, and something else will come back to you through that. So I think that the transition of money from the temporal to the cyberspatial version is really going to make a difference of the way we, you know, think about it and the way we spend things.
What's already in the works here?
Okay, there's been an explosion, just literally in the past couple months, of schemes of people wanting to get into this gold rush. It's almost an oxymoron here, of electronic money. All the credit card companies are looking to expand their operations from, you know, straight, you know, plastic billing, you know, from merchants the way they have now, into some sort of cash, you know, smart card system, Visa and MasterCard. The banks, of course, are extremely interested. And they're all madly making alliances with computer companies and cryptography companies to, you know, make these systems secure. So there's a, you know, probably about half dozen consortiums being formed just in the last year to bring some form of electronic cash to market.
Can you describe a couple of the systems that are already operating?
Okay, well, there's one called Mondex, which is, you know, rolling out next year in England, and they estimate for their first rollout in Swinton, England, they'll have about 40,000 users of these smart cards, and these will be fairly anonymous. They'll be untraceable once you download them. Some people have actually asked questions. They think that the way this particular system is set up, it might be possible to hack. But of course, the people rolling it out are, you know, say that there's no way that anything could go wrong. And that'll be interesting to see next year. There's a pilot project going on with this company called DigiCash, which run by a fellow named David Chaum, who really is the father of anonymous electronic cash. And that works on the network. And right now, they're, you know, giving you the ability to buy information on the net and transfer money from your electronic account, you know, to the place that's selling the information, and that happens all anonymously. The most talked about electronic money venture, we haven't seen the fruits of yet, but when Microsoft bought Intuit, which is a company which gets into personal finance software and has been, you know, working with check operations, it's part of a ongoing Microsoft project in electronic money. They have about five or six cryptographers working there. And some people think that we might exchange our dollar bills for bill dollars one day, that every time you spend some money, Microsoft might get a portion of a penny or maybe a couple cents from the exchange.
If we go to electronic money, might there be a day where the whole computer system crashed and we were all suddenly broke? The equivalent of a stock market crash, but something more far-reaching?
Yeah, the specter of an electronic Chernobyl is one which has not escaped the people who are working in digital cash. And but the funny thing is, in looking into this, is that the infrastructure for the total disaster is already there. Really, as I said before, the big money is already electronic. There's trillions of dollars every day that pass through electronically. So, you know, this danger really is something, you know, is kind of a sort of Damocles lurking over us as we speak. And we can only hope that the, backup systems are in place to prevent this happening.
Electronic money wouldn't be possible without cryptography. Why are the two so entwined?
cryptography is the only way you could really make this stuff secure. A digital dollar really is just a string of numbers. And the same way cryptography has a goal of keeping things secret, of keeping things secure when they're passed over insecure channels, like, you know, through satellites or through the phone system, anything people can get at it. Your money obviously has to be very secure in doing this. Now, banks have used some form of cryptography for years to keep their transactions private and secure. And, you know, you couldn't imagine having the electronic money without strong cryptography.
My guest is Stephen Levy. He's a journalist who writes about computer culture. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen Levy. He writes about e-money in the December issue of Wired. You know, I think it might be a good idea for you to give a basic definition of what cryptography is.
Sure. Cryptography really is the use of secret codes or ciphers to protect communications, to make communications more secure, or to, you know, make documents, you know, such that people can't read them. It is many centuries old. Julius Caesar used cryptography. It's only been in the last few decades that the mathematicians have come up with codes that they believe are uncrackable. And it's only been in the past few years that we've come up with systems that just plain people can use this uncrackable cryptography.
What are the security features needed to make an electronic money system work?
Essentially, what you need is to make the money counterfeit proof, which is quite a challenge, because when you're talking about basically a big number representing cash, fungible cash that you could spend, what is more easy to copy than a string of digits? So it seems almost counterintuitive that you could have some security in, you know, a long string of numbers. And that's where this fellow I mentioned, David Chaum, has done a lot of really innovative work in protecting the security of a string of numbers. I guess even before Chaum, there was a huge breakthrough in cryptography about 20 years ago called public key cryptography that not only provided security, but gave a means of authentication, the equivalent of a digital signature, which, you know, verifies, you know, information as, you know, being legitimate, as being either from a certain person or authorized, you know, by a certain entity. So this digital cash, this string of numbers, is authorized, in essence, backed by a bank or whatever agency authorized it, by use usually of this digital signature technology.
My guest is Stephen Levy. He's the author of the book Insanely Great, which is a history of the Macintosh computer. He's a columnist for Macworld. In the current edition of Wired, he has an article about electronic money. Now, cryptography, which is going to make electronic money possible, is really one of the bigger controversies within the cyber world now. What's the debate about?
Well, the debate is whether we're going to have strong cryptography to ensure our privacy, to protect our money, you know, really, in, you know, whether the strong cryptography is going to be, you know, used in everyday transparent means, meaning people will use it without thinking about it, or whether we'll either have a weakened version of cryptography, or, you know, one which the government can overturn, you know, very easily in its place. Cryptography to protect our communications, to protect our money, is going to be inevitable. But this is an incredible threat to our government and other governments around the world that see the loss of control of listening to people's communications. And, you know, as we talked about earlier, in, you know, keeping track of the way money flows. So this is one of the big battles of cyberspace, really. Who's going to control the cryptography? Is cryptography going to run free and have what some people call the system of crypto anarchy? Or is the government going to rein it in and, you know, will trade off some degree of privacy and security for what the government says is, you know, can benefit the society in terms of curbing in criminals and protecting our national security?
There are different approaches to cryptography that could be used now within the computer world. One approach would be I could send a message to you and absolutely nobody but you would be able to figure out what I had sent you. The government couldn't find out. No one could break the code. But there's another form of cryptography that would allow the government, with a warrant or whatever, to break in and figure out what it was I had sent you.
Yeah, the big breakthrough that I referred to earlier, about 20 years ago, kind of ensured that the technology is there for us to communicate in total privacy if the system's strong enough. And, you know, indeed, systems have been developed and are being circulated to do that. What the government wants is a second form, you know, giving us that strong cryptography, but asking us to yield the government the means to unscramble these codes that we're going to use to communicate with each other in case they have a warrant or it's a national security matter. And this is something called key escrow. It's the equivalent of saying, well, you could have a very strong door to protect intruders from breaking down the door, but you have to leave a key to this door at the police station in case we get a warrant and have to come in and search your apartment or home.
Now, on the other side, you have an interesting assortment of people, you know, ranging from Rush Limbaugh to the ACLU, who are saying we can't give the government the right to intercept our messages. We want privacy.
Yeah, there's two problems with what the government's proposing. First of all, is that what they're suggesting is that people yield their privacy before the point they're under suspicion of anything. And I don't know if there's a constitutional problem with that, but certainly it doesn't feel right to a lot of people to say, you know, well, I'm going to leave this key at the police station, essentially, in case, you know, at some later point there's a warrant against me. The second problem is that some people say it's impossible to enforce anyway because the information to do this cryptography, to do this coding and scrambling is out in the open, and people can use it whether the government tells them not to do it or not. So, you know, the only people who are really going to get caught in this escrow trap are the people who are law-abiding citizens, give up their keys to the government voluntarily. It's quite possible to sidestep what the government wants to do by using these very available means of cryptography.
So there are some pretty big decisions that have to be made in the near future about cryptography, about electronic money. Who's in charge of making the decisions?
Well, the government has a big say in all this. The Clinton administration is, you know, a very strong believer in key escrow, in limiting cryptography and not seeing crypto anarchy, as some people called cypherpunks who are activists in this field put it. So they want to try to stem the tide of technology, really, and keep this stuff from spreading very widely.
Well, Stephen Levy, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Stephen Levy is writing a book on cryptography. His article on e-money is published in the December edition of Wired, and his book Insanely Great on the History of the Macintosh Computer has just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.